From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, conservative columnist and lifelong Republican William Safire tells us why he's thinking the unthinkable. We'll also talk about the quality of political rhetoric during this presidential campaign. Safire was a speechwriter for President Nixon and Vice President Agnew. Now he's a political columnist for the New York Times. He also writes a column on language. Also today, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Night and the City, the remake of the 1950 film noir classic starring Robert De Niro. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Bill Clinton ended his swing through the western United States today with a rally in Las Vegas. Next stops on his agenda are Arkansas and Missouri. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Clinton stumped through Republican territory this week, visiting many states that haven't voted for a Democrat since 1964. In Nevada this morning, he spoke to a crowd of several thousand students at the University of Las Vegas.
I am tired of seeing the American people work harder for less. I am tired of seeing people not be able to get bank loans to start good businesses. I'm tired of seeing people drop out of college because they can't afford to stay in. I'm tired of seeing 100,000 Americans a month lose their health insurance. And I believe we can do better. We can do better. We can do better.
Clinton has been telling Western audiences that he represents a new Democratic Party, a party that stands for better government instead of bigger government. And he celebrated the string of endorsements he's received from Republican-leaning business leaders and retired military officials. In Oregon, he was endorsed by a paper that has supported Republicans since Abraham Lincoln ran for president. In Las Vegas, I'm Mara Liasson.
President Bush is now campaigning in Florida, one of the big electoral vote states that's still regarded as a possible prize for either Republicans or Democrats in this election. In Miami, the president signed a measure tightening the economic embargo on Fidel Castro's Cuba. The increased embargo has drawn opposition from the European Community, Canada, and Mexico, but it's highly popular with Cuban Americans in Florida. Mr. Bush is scheduled to take part in a televised town hall meeting this evening. Democratic vice presidential candidate Al Gore campaigned in Florida earlier today, telling older voters that President Bush is likely to try to increase out-of-pocket costs for Medicare. President Bush has announced that the government of Vietnam will provide all information it has on Americans listed as missing in action or held captive during the Vietnam War. A U.S. delegation returned from Vietnam a few days ago with photographs and war materials. NPR's John Greenberg has more.
The president called the agreement with Vietnam a major breakthrough. His special emissary on POW/MIA affairs, retired General John Vesey, said the evidence his delegation brought back from Vietnam included field reports, combat photos, equipment, and identification cards. Vesey said the Vietnamese presented the information as a symbolic sample of what was available.
It is important material, but the importance is not the material we brought back. The important thing is the material that we expect to get in the days ahead.
So far, the Pentagon has contacted three families on the basis of the new information. The president and members of Congress said continued cooperation from Hanoi would open the door to better relations between the two countries. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
The Dow Industrials gained 7 points today. This is NPR. A court in Paris has sentenced three senior officials of France's health service to prison terms for their part in a blood transfusion scandal. The case against the men was brought on behalf of some 1,200 hemophiliacs given blood contaminated with the AIDS virus in the mid-1980s. More than 250 of them have died. From Paris, the BBC's Stephen Jessel reports.
The court found three senior health service officials guilty, acquitting a fourth. During the trial, the judges heard how for several months in 1984 and 1985, the three men knew that hemophiliacs and others receiving blood transfusions ran the risk of contracting the AIDS virus from contaminated blood. But they did nothing. Partly, it later emerged, because of the costs involved in dumping infected stocks of blood, partly because they didn't want to use an American system for treating blood by heating it, preferring to wait for a French system to be developed. The defendants, who included Michel Garreta, head of the National Blood Transfusion Service, argued that they did not know of the risks involved and took reasonable care, or they sought to place the blame elsewhere. The court sentenced Garreta, who is abroad, to 4 years imprisonment, a second man to 4 years with two of them suspended, and a third man to a four-year term, all of it suspended.
The BBC's Stephen Jessel reporting from Paris. Military officers from the Serbian, Croatian, and Muslim factions in the Bosnian Civil War met for the first time in 7 months today in Sarajevo. The first round of talks was organized by the UN commander in the city, French General Philippe Morillon. The UN commander wants the warring sides to agree on practical steps to ease the plight of Bosnian civilians who are threatened by starvation and freezing as the winter approaches. Muslims refused to take part in the talks until the Serbs restored water and electric power to Sarajevo. General Morillon said the three sides discussed how to establish a truce on the ground. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, William Safire, has described himself as a lifelong Republican and a right-wing pundit with four-square opinions on anything you can name. Safire writes a syndicated political column for the New York Times, and for the Times Sunday Magazine, he writes a popular column on language. So Safire can zap politicians not just for their positions, but for how they state those positions. Safire used to be a speechwriter for the Nixon administration. He has two new books out. One is called The First Dissident, and it analyzes the Old Testament book of Job and applies it to contemporary politics. He's edited a new book of great speeches from history called Lend Me Your Ears. With just a little more than a week left before the presidential election, Safire says he's thinking the unthinkable. He might vote Democrat. I asked him if this would be the first time.
Yes, I've been voting grimly Republican all my life, and I'm my early 62 now. So this is a tough time for me. I even swallowed and went for Goldwater, although I had worked for Rockefeller in that campaign. But this one, I'm stopping and thinking and saying I'm an undecided voter now.
Now, you say that President Bush's attempts to win the right actually alienated the main body of the party. When did he start to lose you?
Well, I was hopeful that he would get some kind of cap on spending on the domestic side. I am a right-winger, and I like to see government, the rate of growth of it, reduced. So that was an irritation. But frankly, and I'm a contrarian, that means I run somewhat differently from most people, even those that agree with me. Mostly what turned me off on George Bush was not the economy, which is not as bad as the Democrats would have us believe now, but was his foreign policy. I thought if there was one moment, it came at the end of the Persian Gulf War, when he urged the Kurdish people to revolt. They did, and they got slaughtered, and we did nothing to save them. Until a few of us were banging our spoons against a high chair and getting all red in the face. And John Sununu in the White House was saying, Safire and the others can write 100 columns, it won't change our policy. But when the television picture started coming on the screen of this almost biblical exodus of refugees from northern Iraq, trying to run away from the retribution that Saddam was wreaking on them. That came into the American living rooms, and there was a revulsion, and people looked to the White House and said, well, you asked these people to rebel. What are you going to do about it? At that point, he followed public opinion and said, okay, you can't fly above the 36th parallel, and we'll protect the Kurds in the mountains.
Where do you place yourself within the Republican Party? Do you see yourself as being in the mainstream of the party, on the far right of the party?
Certainly in the mainstream. Mm-hmm. I think most Republicans are conservative, but not rigid. I would say the reasonable right. There's a hard right, and a religious right, and a mean-spirited right. and they're not necessarily all the same.
Which parts of the right do you think George Bush affiliated himself with?
Certainly he went for the evangelicals. Now, there's nothing wrong with trying to get the evangelical vote. Jimmy Carter did, Ronald Reagan did, and George Bush has. But in so doing, he accepted a platform with a rigid abortion plank, for example, that not even he subscribes to, and that most Republicans just can't go along with. Well, he says, okay, you know, there's a lot of things in the platform that you don't accept or you don't necessarily run on. But in this day, and with the focus on big issues like that, you don't make deals that way. You don't accept that as a platform.
I guess you think it's a counterproductive deal, too, in the sense that he lost people like you in the party by wooing the far right of the party.
Well, there's a way of doing it. You can say, come along with us, and we're much better than the lefties. And you've got no place else to go, and I'll at least listen to you, and I'll respect you, and but I don't necessarily, you know, I won't pander to you. So that's the way Reagan went about it, and he was able to keep their support. But I think most people on the far right, and I have friends there, and certainly correspondents, they feel that George Bush doesn't really believe what they believe, and that they can tell that he's pandering to them on that.
Why do you think he felt he had to do that?
Well, I go back with Bush a long ways as an observer. I remember I was writing speeches back in 1970 for Spiro T. Agnew. Remember the nattering nabobs of negativism? And
sure do, and that was yours. That was your line.
he accredited me with that, so I can accept that. And so we were smiting the liberals and hip and thigh with anti-permissiveness and anti-drug culture and all the things that later Tipper Gore and Dan Quayle and a great many others adopted. In other words, that cultural, call it dissidence, if you will, that required some articulate social answers. All right, so that was that thrust of that campaign. And we were going into Texas, and I remember Bryce Harlow, the great speechwriter and presidential aide, came back in the plane and said, George Bush, our candidate for Senate in Texas, doesn't want us there. It turned out that, okay, we could come into Texas, but only to Amarillo and Lubbock and not to Houston and San Antonio. There was a kind of grudging feeling about it. So I think then we went on to Tennessee, helped the candidate, the Republican candidate there, defeat Al Gore, the father of the present candidate for vice president, who was a liberal. And sure enough, in Texas, probably because he didn't use Agnew well enough or wasn't able to go after the far right using Agnew, George Bush lost to Lloyd Benson in that Senate race. And I think at that point he said, never again. I'll always try to get that far right under my belt. And from a moderate to try to do that, That's a tough stretch.
If you're just joining us, my guest is political columnist William Safire. He has two new books. One is called The First Dissident, The Book of Job in Today's Politics. And the other is a collection of great speeches in history that Safire edited, and it's called Lend Me Your Ears. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is syndicated political columnist William Safire, who writes for the New York Times. The Bush campaign gave Bush's former opponent, Pat Buchanan, a prime place at the Republican convention. You used to work with Buchanan when you were both speechwriters in the Nixon administration. Have your opinions of Buchanan changed over the years?
We've grown apart. We're still friends. We disagree about a whole lot of things, but we agree about a bunch of things. We can talk to each other. I don't like his brand of nativist conservatism, and he probably thinks I'm a Me Too Democrat and a wishy-washy conservative. That's a legitimate difference of opinion between a couple of old speechwriters.
Did you think he went too far at the convention?
Oh, I think he really took Bush over the side. I think he got up there, and by being loyal, by saying, we're for Bush, and he's for our platform, and he's for our law and order, and he's for our this and that, most Americans and most Republicans watching that and watching Pat be tough and hard-hitting and a little bit mean and bullying, I think... said that's not our kind of republicanism, and if that's what George Bush represents, then that's not my party. I think our Houston convention was a disaster. I think James Baker, who came aboard just about that time, a little bit late, deserves great criticism for letting that happen.
So to sum up something that you're saying about Bush, you think that Bush in, I'll use your word, pandering to the far right, alienated the mainstream of the party, but the far right doesn't quite trust him either because they know that that's not where his heart really lies.
That's a fair statement.
No,
I'm not a Clinton man.
Right. Yeah. What are your reservations about Clinton? Obviously, obviously you have plenty of them.
Yeah, I sound kind of like a nattering nabob of negativism here, and I wish I had somebody to be more for. But that's what's the anguishing thing about this election.
Well, I can't see you somehow. You know how all the networks had their panels of undecided people after the debate? Did you imagine yourself on one of those panels?
I've never been undecided. I'm not undecided about anything.
Yeah.
And, I'm of two minds about the word ambivalent. I like to take four square issues on, you name it, I'll come up with an issue, with a position. But on this one, I've been finessed out of my position.
It's occurred to me you really have a position, but you don't want to say it publicly yet.
You mean you think I'm misleading you?
Oh, did I say that? Well, let's get back to your reservations about Clinton.
Well, I do think he's a tax and spend liberal in a centrist mask. And when George Bush says this guy's going to raise your taxes, I think Bush is 100% right. He will raise taxes. I'm a language maven, and I hear Clinton say, we're going to invest. Invest means spend. It's a word that he doesn't want to use, spend. So he talks about investing. But essentially, he's talking about pump priming. He's talking about trying to get out of the recession by the traditional method of fiscal policy, which means spending more money, spend your way out. And I think at this point, we can't afford to do that.
But
nor can we afford a middle-class tax cut, which he's talking about.
Just in terms of the linguistics, I mean, there is a difference between spending and investing. Investing implies that your money will have a payoff, either in more money or in other kind of valuable, measurable ways.
Gee, I don't think any politician would suggest spending for anything else but that. They don't talk about throwing money away.
Mm-hmm.
They talk about Keynesian economics as putting money into circulation for a good cause. But I think when Clinton talks about we'll only tax the 200,000 and above, that's misleading.
Now, what about Ross Perot? What's your take on him?
I think he's a liar and a bully and a threat to civil liberty.
How is he a threat to civil liberty?
Well, first of all, his penchant for... hiring private investigators. I mean, those of us who have been through the Watergate era with Nixon realize that snooping on people and invading their privacy is a terrible mindset, and I think he's got it. I also think he's on an ego trip, and I think he's a poor receptacle for protest.
Now, what are you going to make your final decision on? It's not like you're uneducated about the issues. It's not like, well, if I just
could
learn a little bit more. Yeah, right. So what are you waiting to find out?
Well, one thing is Iraqgate.
Mm-hmm. Which is an issue you've been writing about a long time.
Yeah, and I think essentially that the U.S. built up Saddam Hussein, and mistakenly, that we thought he would be our linchpin of stability in the Middle East, and we shouldn't bet on a bloody dictator that way. And we did build him up, and he double-crossed us, and as soon as the corruption began to be evident in our loans to him, or our guaranteed loans to him, then instead of cutting it off, the Bush administration proceeded to cover it up and pretend it wasn't there.
Well, if you already believe that the Bush administration built up Saddam Hussein and then covered it up, what are you waiting to find out before you decide who you're going to vote for?
Well, whether or not they'll appoint a special prosecutor. They've been ducking that. And I think this week the president has to confront that issue and direct his attorney general to obey the law and appoint an independent counsel and not a phony counsel the way he is, or a patsy prosecutor, as I put it, to try to cover the thing up.
And if there was an investigation, you'd feel better about voting for Bush?
Yeah, I think if he put it in the hands of a special prosecutor, at least that would be saying, okay, let's have an impartial man come in and take a look at it. And maybe it's been overblown and maybe it's been underblown, but at least that's law and order, and that's a kind of important thing for a conservative. That wouldn't be the only determinant of my vote.
What else?
I like the way the president is being more of a gentleman. In his final few weeks.
More of a gentleman?
Yeah. He's my idea of a gentleman in politics is somebody who slams hard, but above the belt. And I think the way he's done it, especially the last debate, and if he comes out of that and uses that as his way of operating, I like that.
Well, he just said this week that he was talking about the debates, and he said, "Don't believe some crackpot who comes on after the debate who's going to tell you what to think." Is that a kind of gentlemanly language, referring to like the journalists as crackpots?
Crackpot is not all that pejorative, is it? I mean, I think that's kind of mild in politics.
Uh-huh.
But. I want to vote for the Republican, but I'm having a great deal of difficulty because of that foreign policy problem.
It seems right now that a lot of Republicans are kind of fighting in public while the Democrats have closed ranks. And isn't it usually the other way around?
Yes. The Democrats have learned ever since the McGovern days that you have to win, then you have to fight. And I think what we'll see if there is a Clinton administration, we'll see all these guys who have been out of power for low these 12 years and desperate to get back in, all the old Carter crowd, coming in and saying, okay, we want a dovish foreign policy and we want a aggressively liberal social agenda. And the guys who directed the Clinton campaign, and Clinton himself said that, that's not the way we won. We won talking centrism and we're talking moderation and all things. But then they'll say, look, we're in, and now let's go liberal, and because we're, after all, we have to stand for something.
So you think the infighting would happen after the election for the Democrats?
Yes, and there'll be a split. It always happens.
Would it change your identity at all if you voted for Clinton in the election?
Well, it would upset me. It would cause something called cognitive dissonance
right.
in my head. But I would immediately feel called upon to hold them to very high standards very quickly. And the honeymoon would be over in a hurry. But, yes, I feel awkward about it.
Now, how do you feel about even talking this way in public? Are you alienating a lot of friends and colleagues?
Oh, no, I don't worry about that. Frankly, a lot of... where is there a Charlie Krauthammer or a George Will or leading political pundit right-wing voices coming out strongly saying, let's all get behind George Bush? There's a paucity of that. It's a remarkable thing. And it's not because all of us are loath to get into a good scrap. It's just that we just, I don't speak for the others, I speak strictly for myself. I think we feel kind of abandoned, so we'll abandon too, maybe.
Mm-hmm. This feels unprecedented to you, this lack of enthusiasm for the Republican candidate?
Well, let's see. Back in the Nixon era, there were Nixon people. I mean, he had a solid core of loyalists. And even in the worst days, there were 35 to 40% of the people who stuck with him. And he was controversial, and the liberals hated his guts, and he hated them right back. But he had his loyalists. Same thing with Kennedy. You could always find Kennedy loyalists to stick up for Kennedy even after Camelot came apart. But Bush loyalists, much fewer and far between.
If a Democratic administration is elected, you know, if Bill Clinton wins, would that be good or bad for your place in the world as a conservative political columnist?
Well, I survived the Carter administration, and I tell you the truth, I kind of enjoyed it, and I got a Pulitzer during it, and I, you know, was able to quickly focus on the mishaps and the hypocrisies in it. And if the Clinton administration strays from its pronounced principles, you'll hear from me.
But you've got them elected already.
I said if, well...
If they get elected.
You've caught me. You've caught me out, and I would have to say if you were betting now, you'd have to bet on them. But it ain't over till it's over. To use the favorite cliche of this campaign.
You can't possibly answer it in a minute, but do you think you were born conservative, or was there something like really big in your life that changed you?
I was about 19 or 20, and somebody said, how'd you like to work on the Eisenhower-Madison Square Garden rally? And gee, I was, you know, that was a lot of fun. And I plunged in, and that got me into politics, and my mindset, my headset was with Republicans. Had somebody given me the opportunity with Stevenson, I would imagine I would have been exposed to that. I like to think that now that I'm a little more mature, I would have thought it through. But when you're getting in early, you get in where the getting's good.
Well, it wasn't a statement of undying passion for a cause that you just made.
Well, no, I'm a conservative now because I think about it.
William Safire is the author of the new book, The First Dissident, The Book of Job in Today's Politics. He edited the new book, Lend Me Your Ears, Great Speeches in History. Safire will be back with us in the second part of our show to talk about speech writing and political rhetoric. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Nattering Nabobs of Negativism. William Sapphire tells us how he wrote that now famous alliterative phrase for Vice President Spiro Agnew. In this second part of our conversation, Sapphire will talk with us about his days as a political speechwriter and share his impressions of political rhetoric in this presidential campaign. Sapphire writes a political column and a language column for the New York Times. Robert De Niro and Jessica Lange are starring in a new movie about con games in New York City. It's called Night and the City, and it's a remake of a 1950 film noir. Stephen Schiff has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush is in Miami this evening as he headed south again this morning on another campaign swing. Mr. Bush is hoping to strengthen support in states that have voted Republican in the past several presidential elections. NPR's David Mopus reports from Miami.
President Bush is not unveiling any new campaign themes on this latest swing south, but he is delivering his message with a rejuvenated zeal. He gleefully refers to Democratic vice presidential candidate Al Gore as Mr. Ozone. He dismisses those nutty pollsters, as he calls them, and promises during a second term to bring down health insurance rates by going after what he calls those crazy malpractice suits. The message is somewhat scattershot, encompassing at least two dozen topics in one typical 20-minute speech. But Mr. Bush does seem to be hitting his stride, and the crowds are energized as well. About 10,000 cheered the president on in rural Kentucky earlier today, and a Cuban-American audience gave the president a rousing reception in Florida tonight. I'm David Mopus with the Bush campaign in Miami.
Democratic presidential contender Bill Clinton wrapped up his western state campaign swing today, starting the day in Nevada. From there, he traveled to Wisconsin, where he told a rally that if voters study the various economic plans presented to them, he will win hands down. Clinton said that he was encouraged by Vietnam's release of more information on Americans missing in action, but said it was far too early to talk about restoring full diplomatic relations. For the first time since officially entering the presidential race, independent presidential candidate Ross Perot takes his campaign on the road this weekend. Bill Zeeble of member station KERA in Dallas reports.
On Sunday, the independent candidate heads for the East Coast. He's scheduled to appear first at a Perot campaign rally in Flemington, New Jersey, and then at another rally in Pittsburgh. Exactly 3 weeks ago, when he announced he'd run, Perot made it clear his campaign would be unlike the others. Since then, he's appeared at the presidential debates and mostly on his 30-minute TV advertisements. Those paid political shows continue tonight and tomorrow with another hour of TV network time purchased from Monday. None of his so-called infomercials will air when he makes his campaign appearances Sunday. Perot headquarters says family members and vice presidential running mate James Stockdale may appear at other rallies, but no plans were confirmed. For National Public Radio, I'm Bill Zeeble in Dallas.
President Bush announced this morning that Vietnam has agreed to share all its information on missing American servicemen. This includes pictures and field reports along with military files. The president has said in return he is prepared to provide humanitarian aid to Vietnam. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 7 points to close at 3,207.64. This is NPR News. A breakdown in talks between U.S. and British officials on more open airline competition has apparently delayed an agreement between British Airways and U.S. Air. Transportation Secretary Andrew Card had flown to London for talks there this week, but they were broken off and won't resume until after the U.S. elections. According to the Reuters News Service, quoting industry sources, U.S. officials want approval of the British Air-U.S. Air agreement to follow an open skies agreement, while Britain wants an open skies agreement first. The primary goal for astronauts on the space shuttle Columbia has been completed as they released an Italian satellite from the shuttle's cargo bay. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
LAGEOS 2 will sit in an orbit 3,600 miles high, bouncing laser beams to receiving stations back on Earth. The satellite, which is only 2 feet in diameter, will undergo several systems checks before being approved for service. Scientists will begin using LAGEOS 2 in about 30 days. Now that the primary mission of Columbia has been completed, the crew will focus their attention on the other tasks at hand. NASA will test out a new vision system for the bulky robotic arm, perhaps improving its ability to grasp objects and put them where needed. Officials are also awaiting the results of an experiment using 12 rats. Half were left alone, the other half were injected with a drug, as scientists look for a better understanding of bone loss and osteoporosis among humans. The mission is scheduled to end with a landing in Florida on Sunday, November 1st. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
Tropical storm Frances is picking up strength as it moves across the Atlantic. Forecasters say the storm now has winds of up to 65 miles an hour and could become a hurricane in 24 hours. A tropical storm warning and a hurricane watch have been posted for the island of Bermuda now that the storm is some 300 miles away. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. William Safire is back with us to talk about speechwriting and political rhetoric. He was a speechwriter for President Richard Nixon and Vice President Spiro Agnew. Now Safire writes the On Language column for the New York Times Magazine. He also writes a syndicated political column. I want to talk to you about speeches of this campaign as a former speechwriter yourself and as the editor of a new book of speeches in history. First of all, we see some of George Bush's lines are coming back to haunt him, like, read my lips and kinder and gentler nation. Is this a typical problem with speeches, that some of the lines that stand out the most can be turned against you if things go sour?
Oh, sure. Nixon, in a press conference, said, look, I'm not a crook, when accused of some venality or some stealing money. Well, he wasn't stealing money, and he wasn't a crook. So, yes, effective lines, strongly delivered and well-believed lines, often come and clobber you. Read My Lips, for example, is now slamming back at George Bush. It was an excellent rhetorical device by Peggy Noonan, who's a superb speechwriter. And quite frankly, it's a pity that both Peggy and particularly Ray Price, who was one of my associates in the Nixon era, who was a specialist in uplift and idealism, it's a pity that he wasn't permitted to finish the speech of George Bush at the acceptance in the Houston Convention this year.
What did you think of Bush's speech?
Terrible. I thought it was an hour long, which is a good 20 minutes too long. And I thought it was kind of a rehash of the State of the Union, which never went anywhere anyway. And it wasn't thematic, and it wasn't open-armed. It didn't say, come on in, and here's how we'll be different next year. He talked about identifying himself with Harry Truman, and there's something phony about that. He's not Harry Truman.
When George Bush accuses Bill Clinton of waffling and Bush says, we're not going to turn the White House into the Waffle House, is that effective or is that adolescent?
I think a more effective one was trickle-down. You heard the
trickle-down. The trickle-down government?
Well, trickle-down economics is all you've been hearing from Clinton. And the curious thing is that rhetorically, you can't put a nomics suffix on a person whose name doesn't end with an N. You know, you can talk about Reaganomics, you can talk about Nixonomics, but you can't talk about Carteromics or Bushomics or Bushnomics. So you have to get another characterization. Of course, you will be able to talk about Clintonomics if it comes to pass. So you have to have another characterization. So he reached back to the 1930s and talked about the trickle-down theory, which most people don't really remember too well, but it has something to do with helping the rich so that ultimately the poor get helped. So he's jamming away at trickle-down economics, and the Republicans were taking it on the chin for that. And then finally somebody came up with, well, why don't we zap back with trickle-down government? And that's what the Democrats are trying to sell. So that was a nice comeback.
Now, you were a speechwriter in the Nixon Agnew administration, your most famous line was for Agnew when he was attacking the press, and the line was the nattering nabobs of negativism.
No, he wasn't attacking the press in that speech.
Wasn't he attacking the press?
Pat Buchanan wrote a ring-a-ding speech for him in Des Moines, in which he zapped the press and talked about instant analysis and indeed changed press coverage of politics for a generation as a result. I did a speech out in San Diego about the nattering nabobs of negativism, which was against pessimists. And I took my text from Adlai Stevenson, who was against the prophets of doom and gloom.
Do you think nattering nabobs of negativism is a bit too much on the alliteration?
Well, I kind of liked it, I tell you the truth. I gave him another one, the hysterical hypochondriacs of history. And
wait, wasn't it the hopeless hysterical?
Yes, right. There was a, right. There was a fourth H in there.
Yeah.
But we didn't use it because of the 4-H clubs. So we didn't. We thought they would not like it. But alliteration was sort of thrust into the American consciousness by Warren G. Harding, who talked about not nostrums but normalcy, not experiment but equipoise, and he went on for about 10 more alliterations.
So you didn't think there were too many ends in that?
Well, it seems to have lasted.
I mean, right.
If you only had two, I don't think it would have gone. For example, Pat Buchanan came up with pusillanimous pussyfooters, and that never went. I think it needed a third P.
I think maybe it was too hard to pronounce.
Could be, too.
Well, of all the lines that you've written for, you know, in speeches, do you have favorites that stand out in your mind? Ones that you're particularly proud of?
You're asking me to break the code. You can't break the code.
What? Explain the code.
The code is unless the principal specifically cites your work as coming from you, then you stand there and say, I worked with so-and-so on that speech, and it's his speech or her speech.
And what is the function of that code?
That's the law of the speechwriters, and the function of it is the speechwriter should not get the credit for the speech, because after all, although a writer might create the words, they are accepted or rejected by the person responsible for them. And so I think when a speechwriter today gets the focus placed on him or her, it somewhat demeans the speaker.
Is the other function of the code so that the politician isn't embarrassed when voters think, well, he didn't write that anyway. This is a great line, but it was really the speechwriter who came up with it. We can't really give you, the politician, any credit for it.
We're, in most cases, in most political speeches, it's a give and take between the writer and the politician. I used to do that with Nixon, I remember. I would go in there and sit down, and he would say, these are the points I want to make. And I would give him a draft, and he would say, you know, you had a great opening and a pretty good close, but the middle is terrible. And I would redo it and give it back to him, and he'd say, I like this line, and whatever happened to that line we used in the speech 2 years ago, and he'd bring that back. And it's a collaboration, and that, I think, is the best kind of speech writing.
If you're just joining us, my guest is political columnist William Safire. He has two new books. One is called The First Dissident, The Book of Job in Today's Politics. And the other is a collection of great speeches in history that Safire edited, and it's called Lend Me Your Ears. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is syndicated columnist William Safire. He has two new books. One is called The First Dissident, The Book of Job in Today's Politics. And the other is an anthology of great speeches in history that he edited. It's called Lend Me Your Ears. Do you think rhetoric, political rhetoric is changing now? Do you think it's become more dependent on kind of TV conversationality, you know, conversational quality as opposed to speech-making quality?
The grand speech made at a convention. You don't see too much of. Ronald Reagan was a good speechmaker, but he didn't make the grand oratory. He spoke directly to people on television. The decision you make in a convention is, do you talk to the hall and have the viewer at home feel like part of a vast audience, or do you use the convention as a prop and speak directly into the camera and speak to the viewer as an individual? There's an argument to be made for both, and depending on what you're good at. Ted Kennedy, for example, is very good in a hall and terrible speaking directly to the viewer.
In your book about Job, you write, I started my journey with doubt in my faith and have come out with faith in my doubt. And then you kind of parenthetically say, that's a great speechwriter's trick, you know, to...
That's the turnaround line.
The turnaround, right. Mm-hmm. Right. What are some of the other great speechwriter tricks?
Well, the most famous one along those lines is let us not fear to negotiate, but let us, you know, let us not negotiate out of fear. Kennedy used to use those contrabuntal, or Ted Sorensen used to suggest them fairly frequently, and so did Churchill. The tricks, the anaphora, the repetition of a particular phrase or line, the beginning of let us, Lincoln used let us do this, let us do that, and everybody else since then has been using it. There are various oratorical tricks, but frankly, the tricks are not what make a speech. It's first, what do I have to say, and how can I move people with this?
You worked as a speechwriter with the Nixon administration. I think it was after you left that you found out about Watergate. After you left the administration, you found out your own home and office phones had been tapped. When you found out that your phones had been tapped, did that change your mind about Nixon, about the party, about politics in general?
It sure got me angry. I was always a big believer in privacy, and I'm a libertarian. I think government should butt out of people's lives as much as possible. And so when I learned that I was being tapped, and I was an old loyalist from way back, and I was being tapped by a bunch of Johnny's come lately. The plural of Johnny come lately is Johnny's come lately. I objected strenuously, and it did diminish my respect for the Nixon team, but I remained a Nixon loyalist anyway.
Why?
Well, I'd had a lot of equity in there, and I respected Nixon for a lot of the things that he did.
But somebody in the administration obviously didn't respect you if they were tapping your phone.
Right, and I had a fairly severe reaction there, and I zapped him. And at that point, I was a pundit for the New York Times, and I blazed away at him.
You thought it was Kissinger?
I thought it was Al Haig and Kissinger and John Mitchell.
And why do you think your phone was being tapped?
Oh, I was consorting with known journalists. And
were you leaking things to them?
Well, as a matter of fact, I remember what occasioned it all. I was working on a welfare reform speech, the speech known as Nixon's Good Deed, where he actually came up with a wonderful program that George Shultz and Pat Moynihan had worked on. And Nixon told me, you know, get this around to everybody and leak it beforehand and make sure that it gets covered. So I was speaking to some reporter, and I said, hey, next week this will be this terrific speech, and you know, you got to do it. Here's some of the things that will be in it. The FBI was listening to that reporter and said, aha, you see, there's a White House aide leaking. And so that triggered a tap on my phone for carrying out what the president asked me to do.
Hmm. You are
See, I was wrong about Watergate. I didn't think it would be a big deal. That's what's got me sensitized to abuses of power. And that's why today I'm interested in Iraqgate.
It strikes me that during this presidential campaign, people are just really tuned in to the campaign in a way that I can't remember happening before. And, you know, everybody watched the debates each night that they were on, and it's really become the national drama in a way I don't remember it being before. And I wonder if you feel that way, too, and if so, what you think explains it.
Well, it's a wonderful thing to see how all the political analysts and scientists who were bemoaning the fate of the republic, watching the participation go down to 50%, in those eligible to vote actually voting. This year they're predicting over 60%. We'll see what the actual result is, but they have registered more people, and the debates were stimulating and were watched by a pretty good audience. And I think that's part of the ebb and flow of American politics, and you can't really tell. I think we have an economic stagnation now, and we're irritated about it, and we want to do something about it. And that's what's got people riled up, and riled up about the president particularly, and willing to take a chance on change. Most of the time, people don't like to take a chance on change.
When you worked with the Nixon and Agnew administration, they were very outspoken in putting down the press. You're a member of the press now. I don't know if you wrote any of the lines particularly addressed to criticizing, you know, the press, but do you feel like the things that you used to criticize?
Well, I never criticized the press. I only criticized the media. There's a
difference. Oh yes. Shall we split hairs over that one?
Oh, listen, that's my. You're talking about my Dodge. I think, quite frankly, the media are criticizable. I construe that as plural. And the press is criticizable, particularly by the press and by the media. That's the best kind of criticism, when we zap each other for being a bunch of liberals or a bunch of hidebound conservatives, and it's this nice self-cleaning process. When politicians criticize us and use our lack of popularity, which is almost down as low as politicians, and appeal to people by saying that the damn media won't let me say this or won't cover me, that's a device. And we have to recognize it and let those peas roll off our life.
William Safire, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks very much, Terry.
William Safire is the author of the new book, The First Dissident, The Book of Job in Today's Politics. He edited the new book, Lend Me Your Ears, Great Speeches in History. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Alan Tomlinson reports on the Cuba Democracy Act that's included in the U.S. defense bill signed today by President Bush. It's intended to tighten the trade embargo against Cuba. This campaign year, it has lots of political overtones. Once again, we'll review the campaign days of George Bush and Bill Clinton and a discussion about trouble with refugees in Bosnia and Croatia. There was a release set for Monday, but no country is stepping forward to offer even temporary asylum of those refugees. Norway has taken 92 refugees in the past. The United States has taken 100. New Zealand is talking about taking 50, but that leaves 10,000 refugees in jeopardy in the prison camps.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. As a movie producer, Irwin Winkler was responsible for some of the more interesting films of the last few decades, from Point Blank and They Shoot Horses, Don't They, to Rocky, The Right Stuff, and Raging Bull. In 1991, he made his directorial debut with Guilty by Suspicion, starring Robert De Niro. Now he's directed a new De Niro movie, a remake of Jules Dassin's classic 1950 film noir, Night in the City. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
In Guilty by Suspicion, Winkler was trying to be serious and issue-oriented in the style of one of the directors he once produced, Sidney Pollack. But that movie turned out to be dead on the screen. It was all message and no energy. So this time, Winkler's model is the most energetic director he's ever worked with, Martin Scorsese. Like a typical Scorsese film, Night in the City bounces with jukebox music and raucous bar scenes. The camera swings and jumps, and the narrative rhythm is full of New York swagger. Better still, the screenplay is by Richard Price, who has an incomparable ear for urban street blarney. His mouthpiece is Harry Fabian, played by Robert De Niro. He's a shameless ambulance-chasing lawyer who gets it into his head that he can break into the world of comfort and ease by becoming a boxing promoter. For this, he needs two things he doesn't have: money and brains. The brains, well, that's a lost cause. But for the money, he turns to the owner of his favorite bar. That's Phil, played by Cliff Gorman. Phil quite properly tells him to take a hike, which is always the wrong thing to tell a motormouth like Harry.
Take a hike? Take a hike? With all due respect, a man comes to you, offers you 20 large back on a $15,000 loan. A man you've known for years, Phil, years. Take a hike. Come on, how could you say that to me, Phil? Really? Come on, how could you say that to me? Bing, bang, in a bag, a paper bag, back to you, right from the ticket, take it to you, Phil. I won't even touch it. 2,000 seats and 15 a pop plus beer. I will not make it back, Phil. Come on, with all due respect.
You get out of my face, okay. Fabian.
Look, I don't want to use the word.
Whether you like this film or not depends a lot on how much hyperkinetic street wheedling you can take. My capacity turned out to be pretty high. Partly because, even though Harry Fabian is a paper-thin character, this is the liveliest and most lived-in performance De Niro has given in years. He doesn't make the mistake of emphasizing Harry's pathos. He just lets the little worm squirm until right when you least expect it, he nearly breaks your heart. During the course of the movie, Harry destroys himself on the way to the brass ring we know he can never grasp. He's stupid enough to hound Phil for a loan, even though he's sleeping with Phil's sultry wife, well played by Jessica Lange. And he's stupid enough to contrive this cockamamie boxing scheme, even though that puts him in direct competition with the meanest thug in the neighborhood, Boom Boom Goldman, played by Alan King with a broken nose prosthetic and a gorgeous bulldog snarl. In the original Jules Dassin movie starring Richard Widmark, Harry's various missteps were like an oily chain coiling around him, and the effect was clammy and scary and dark. But Price's over-the-top dialogue and De Niro's wild gesticulations turn Harry into a comic character. This is film noir transformed into farce, and in the end it doesn't quite work. Harry isn't funny enough for belly laughs or vulnerable enough to make us fear for him. Besides that, Winkler botches the climax, and he never transcends the feeling that this movie is a remake. The boxing milieu, and even the bits of urban texture like a nun begging door-to-door, feel like 40-year-old leftovers. Still, the combination of Price's jumpy dialogue and De Niro's jangly energies can work on you. Night in the City is the perfect movie for ex-New Yorkers, the ones who want a two-hour taste of all that energy and a reminder of why they left.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Roberta Shurrock directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, vote early and often for Curly. We look back on the era of ethnic politics in America with Jack Beatty, the author of a biography of James Curly, the former mayor of Boston. Curly's name was synonymous with Boston Irish and Boston politics. He was alternately called a crook and a saint. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.